Welcome back to another episode of the Kevin O'Connor Show. We got Drew Hanlon. You probably know the name. He works with players like Jason Tatum, Bradley Beal, Joel Embiid, a whole bunch of people around the NBA, Tyrese Halliburton. The list is long with him. We talked about NBA Finals contenders today, the teams that are the favorites, and then those teams that could potentially move themselves into that contender category post All-Star break. Great conversation with Drew, who also just released a book, Stop BSing Yourself. We touched on some of the lessons that he had in that book as well, but we talked about a whole bunch of NBA teams as well. Let's get right into it with Drew. I'm here with Drew Hanlon, NBA skills coach, author of Stop BSing Yourself. Drew, what's up, man?
I'm glad we finally got to do this. Obviously, you and I talk a ton, like via Twitter, via text message, and you know, every time we see each other at a game. But first time getting in front of a camera together. It's nice.
First time doing a podcast. I'm excited about it, man. We'll talk a little bit about your book later. First, I want to start out with something you posted on X. I thought it was a really insightful stat. We've talked a little bit about some of this in recent years, but you posted over the last 33 years, the 33 NBA champions, 31 of them have had a player finish in the top seven in NBA MVP voting. Of the last 41 champions, 37 of them hit 40 wins before taking their 20th loss. And then you wrote on X, at this point in the season, history says this year's contenders are the Cavs, Thunder, Celtics, Knicks, and Nuggets. Now, that's a good list of teams. I agree with that list of teams. Are there any teams not on that list that you think could work themselves into belonging on it in the second half of the year after the break?
Yeah, you know, the funny thing was I had so many people that came up and responded and were like, well, there's a big trade, like a Luka, that could shake things up because normally a top five player doesn't get, you know, transferred to a different team. There's teams that are, you know, unhealthy, like the 76ers, where if Joel Embiid reclaims his health, you know, they would have been one of those top teams and he would have been a top seven player. You also have teams like Phoenix where everyone's like, on paper, we still don't understand why they're not a contender. Or you have a Jimmy Butler move where it's like the Warriors, can they figure out some secret sauce to really push forward? But every year I have that stat because I'm like, you have to have a guy. And people don't understand that, like, the champions always have a guy. And so all these teams that are well-balanced teams, all their fans will hit me up and be like, no, you don't understand. Like, and they always reference the Detroit Pistons. That's always the one that people go to.
It's one of the greatest defenses ever.
One of the greatest defenses ever. But also, they had guys that were up there in the Player of the Year conversation, the MVP conversation. So, you know, yeah, they had a bunch of Hall of Famers and were really good defensively. But I think that that list is even funny because that could even shrink. A couple of those teams have to do some good work to get to the 40-20. But truth is, I do think that the NBA is more spread out than it ever has been before. You know, historically, I think you do see more dominant teams at the top. And I don't know if it's the play-in that's allowed some teams to survive. But, you know, I have clients that would be mad at me if I said their teams couldn't come back and contend and stuff like that. But I think those are the true contenders at this moment.
So is there anybody like the Bucks? I mean, they have Giannis, who you've been working with this past year. He's a top 10, top player, definitely a top five player. Damian Lillard is still a great player. They'd add Kuzma at the deadline. That's going to change things for them. I think they're a team that at least belongs in the, well, maybe.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think the Bucks obviously have a top seven guy. You know, if the Sixers had Joel healthy, that's a top seven guy. You know, you look at somebody like the Warriors, and the West is so spread out. We don't kind of know what's going on in the Wild Wild West right now. But the Warriors, if Steph Curry is doing what he's doing, I love the pick and roll combination where Jimmy's setting screens and playmaking when they double and blitz.
Rolling a lot, like they're doing some creative. There was a play they had recently where they passed it to Draymond in the corner, and Jimmy cut into the paint. It's like, it's like a strange little action with Jimmy with his like downhill ability drawing defense in.
Yeah, so I mean, I think there's those teams that can. You know what I mean? And I don't think that there's, you know, any teams that are like big surprises that are going to come out of the woodworks. You know, I would say that those top teams, the reason that they're dominant throughout the year is because they've been able to figure it out. It's just hard to figure it out when it matters. And we've seen some teams go on runs, you know, the Indiana Pacers. Yeah. We see the, you know, Atlanta Hawks come to mind in recent years. But it's harder for those teams to actually get it done and win it all.
It's definitely tough, but at the same time, like, the Bucks are the team that I think of the teams not on that list, even if they don't reach that 40-20 threshold we're talking about. Giannis will be a top seven MVP guy. He'll probably finish third, maybe fourth. I can't imagine it would be lower than that, but we'll see how the season finishes with the games missed now. But he's having the best season of his career shooting from mid-range. You've been working with him on that this past year. He's shooting 46.1% from mid-range on 4.7 attempts. Both of those are career highs after a career in which he's attempted 2.6 mid-range shots per game, made only 35.6% of them. That is a difference maker for the Bucks with him adding that layer. What's gone into that to help Giannis add that to his game?
Yeah, I mean, as you know, I mean, I know you've been for a couple months been like, Drew, can we share the story? Can we share the story of you guys working together? And we try to keep it a lot of private. But what I would just say is a couple of mechanical things. You know, I mean, obviously him shooting on the way up, obviously, you know, him adding more rhythm and, you know, increasing his arc. But the truth is, you know, you can just see how much it's opened his game, just allowing him to knock down mid-range shots. Also, you know, passing out of the post, being able to hit that turnaround, you know, fadeaway over the right shoulder. So, you know, I think it's just that's what great players do is they constantly find ways to improve and evolve their game. And, you know, in recent years, you've seen that, you know, he hasn't been able to play in the last two playoffs. And so I think that, you know, from his perspective, he just wanted to add another element to his game so that it didn't put as much wear and tear on his body throughout the regular season so that ultimately he could be at his best when it matters in the playoffs.
I mean, it's going to be interesting. They had Kuzma at the deadline trading Chris Middleton. And obviously Middleton, when he was in his prime, totally healthy, he was vital to their deeper postseason runs. They make a conference finals. Obviously, they win an NBA finals. But with Kuzma, it is going to be interesting to see if Doc Rivers and that coaching staff is going to play a little Giannis at the five with Kuzma, because now they have more size in their front court. Do you think that's a tool that could be something that would help the Bucks can take a completely different shape in this second half of the season to kind of put themselves back into that category as a true contender?
Yeah, I mean, I think every team is chasing the Celtics in the Eastern Conference. I know that the Cavs are having an amazing season, but I think that, you know, the mutual feeling between all the, you know, the top players in the league is like the Celtics are still the big dogs out East.
They're defending champions.
Of course. And so I think that when you look at the matchups, you know, you have guys like KP that, you know, spread the floor at the five a lot of times. Even Al Horford, you know, he's been able to stretch defenses out with his pick and pop play. So if you can match up with them, which is hard because they have so many, you know, guys that have height for their position, you know, going all the way from Drew Holiday and Derek, or, you know, Dwight and those guys. And then obviously the Jays on the wings. And then you have these, you know, guys like KP and Al. So it's just, they're so tall for the position that you kind of have to match up. And I think that's why, you know, it was interesting to go get a Kuzma, just because I think it was like, all right, if we are going to try to go a little bit more fresh, you know, at the wing position, we still have to have somebody that's taller or longer that can at least match up. And sliding Giannis to five is obviously something that they'll probably try against them, just because it allows you to switch more. Because if you don't switch against the Celtics, it's just hard. They're going to just rain threes. If you do switch, the hard part is now you're on an island with JT and you have to be able to stay in front and contain the ball. So that's what the, you know, the matchup problem is with the Celtics. And so I think that him being at the five could add a layer of kind of a matchup that could work for the Bucks.
Well, and that is what makes Cleveland like a legitimate threat, though. Because like they can go with the two bigs, Mobley and Allen. They can play Mobley alone at the five when he's that super versatile, switchable big. They have a bunch of wings. They get DeAndre Hunter at the deadline. Dean Wade, great defender, good shooter as well. Max Strus has a bit size at the wing as well. Garland and Mitchell are small, but they can play some of those big lineup configurations for, I think, what could be an actual legitimate, seriously competitive seven-game series. Point is, I don't think Cleveland is just some regular season, oh, they're the new Utah Jazz, they win 60 plus games story. I think they're legit as a contending team.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I think that, you know, obviously their trade deadline was really good, adding another guy that gives them another set of fouls, Hunter's another good, guy dude. That can
more
get
than
into
three
the ball.
And D. More than 3 and D guy.
Yeah, 100%. So I like their team a lot. Obviously, it'll be interesting to see what they do in the playoffs when, you know, a lot of times in the playoffs, what happens is teams just really hunt mismatches. And it's why, like, you see, like, Portland, when they had Dame and CJ, and it's like, they're so good. How can they not get over the hump? It's like, just because they attack that mismatch over and over and over again. Early in Steph's career, that was one of the things that teams did, was just hunted him. And then once he got to the point where he was strong enough with his core and wasn't a defensive liability, you actually saw that a lot of times it hurt teams when they tried to hunt him too much because it took them out of their own offense and stuff like that, because Steph was able to hold his ground. So it'll be interesting to see if, you know, the Cavs can kind of avoid that being hunted mentality when the playoffs come. But I mean,
With Mitchell and Garland,
just two small guards. It's just historically, it just hasn't worked when it came postseason time, you know? And so that'll be something to watch for. But I do think that them having so many rim protectors and taller wings definitely does allow them to plug the gaps, rotate over, tilt the floor, and make it a lot harder than just straight line drives and post-ups, which is what you a lot of times see with players that are undersized.
Now, of those last 33 champions with a top seven MVP, the two that didn't have it were the 04 Pistons, as you mentioned, and the 14 Spurs. The four teams that didn't reach 40 wins before 20 losses were the 95 Rockets, They had Hakeem, the 01 Lakers, Shaq and Kobe. So that was their repeat year before the three-peat. The 04 Pistons again, all-time great defense, multiple Hall of Famers, and the 06 Heat with Shaq and D-Wade on that team. One of the, like, there's a trend there. A lot of Hall of Famers on all of those teams. Great defenses as well. Like, Shaq missed a little bit of time at the beginning of the season with that Lakers season as well, but he still played over 70 games. There's, like, no super unhealthy team where a guy played 40 or 50 games. And that's where, like, with Philly, like, historically, they'd be the true outlier if they managed to play themselves back in, they get in through the play-in and somehow beat, you know, Cleveland or Boston or whoever it might be as a 7 or 8 seed. They would be the first team to ever do that in NBA history, which is a real shame because Embiid's still a great player. It's just they're 8-9 in the games he's played. 8-9, only 17 games in the middle of February right now. You've known Embiid since he came in as a rookie. I believe you started training him then. I'd imagine, like, this is one of those, what feels like a lost season. But is there any hope that you think for this team to kind of turn things around in the second year? Are you holding on at all with them?
It's funny because obviously with each and every one of my clients, you know, we have all these, you know, conversations and stuff like that. You know, the thing that I love about Joel is he really does believe that, like, if he's healthy and he's on the floor, he has a chance to beat anybody. You know, this year when he came back against Boston, they beat him. And you just see, like, you're like, wait, that's a team that everybody thought they were going to be like. And, you know, he's not the only one nursing injuries. You know, there's a couple guys that have been, you know, in and out of the lineup.
Paul George, it was reported he's getting shots that would usually be reserved for a player in the playoffs. Like, and he's been, I mean, he's
yeah,
not
I mean,
good.
And Maxey's been out a couple games. You had McCain, who was really doing well early in the season.
Rookie
he's
of the
been
year.
Out. Yeah,
so, he would have been here this weekend at All-Star Weekend.
Yeah, so there's a, you know, there's a lot of things that have gone on in Philly this year that have been very unfortunate. Obviously, not the path that everyone thought this team was going to go on this year, but you know, like I always tell people, like, Joel is that good that he could, you know, go on a run if he was healthy. He's been very unfortunate in the playoffs, especially. And, you know, the one thing that I think gets criticized all the time is like, oh, Joel never gets a healthy playoffs because he's out of shape. And I'm like, let's rewind and let's look at the injuries. You know, one time he got elbowed by Pascal Siakam. That has nothing to do with cardio. One time Markelle Fultz ran into him and broke his face. That has nothing to do with cardio. Another time he's chased down block, leg gets caught up. Nothing to do with cardio. Another time comes down for a rebound, hyperextension, nothing to do with cardio. Another time he breaks his finger, nothing to do with cardio. So I think that a lot of fans give Joel a hard time for never getting the job done, which is fair criticism. He has not won a championship, but you know, he hasn't had a healthy postseason run. And so that's the one thing that Joel has just been, you know, really trying to focus on is like, how can I eventually get to the playoffs? And I don't care what our record is. I don't care what our seed is. If I'm out there and I'm healthy for 2 month playoff run, he's like, I just want to see what I can do at my best. And so whether it's this year or, you know, a year to come, I think that's the only thing that he cares about is like, give me at least a chance, a shot with no injuries in the playoffs to just give me a run and let's see what happens then.
I mean, part of me has wondered if maybe this will be kind of like the reverse story where it's like in the past for Philadelphia, it's been starts out awesome, ends with some of those freakish injuries, like you said, ends with the team not performing up to expectations in the postseason. Maybe this will be the year. It starts out horribly. It feels like everything's a disaster. And then he manages to stay healthy April and May and gets past the second round or maybe goes deeper. Maybe it could be that type of year. But then you see things where it's like, oh, wait, McCain gets hurt. And then you see Paul George score 2 points on 1 of 7 in a game they lose to the Nets when Oubre and Quentin Grimes both go off for 30. And it's like, well, wait a minute. This just feels like false hope. And that's where I'm at with Philadelphia, where it's like, man, like in theory, George getting back to himself, Maxey, who you also train, has ascended to a high level. If Embiid can just be out there, like statistically, if you still look at the numbers when he's in drop coverage and pick and roll, still dominant this year, despite being in on and off the floor. Offensively, he has not posted the same numbers because he's not in a rhythm. But I think if he's able
even,
to play.
But even there, we were talking about this the other day. Somebody was looking at when. So there's been a couple of games where he, you know, hadn't been able to play the whole game because whether it was load management or whatever. But when he plays at least 30 minutes, he's still averaging like 29 points a game.
In 3 games, he's played 30 minutes? You know, how many?
No, there's a bigger number. We'd have to look up the exact thing. But it's, you know, in 10 games that he's played 30 minutes, he's averaging like 28, 29 points a game.
10 games at the break. That's the concern, though.
100%. The health. But I'm just saying when he's out there and he's healthy, that's always the asterisk. And so I always say it's fair criticism for people that say, well, he's not healthy.
Yeah.
Understand that he has not, you know, at 7 foot, 280 pounds and doing the things that he does offensively and defensively, he's not healthy. But that's the thing that I love about Joel. Even though, you know, he hasn't been able to put together a postseason run with health and you know, the run to the championship that he ultimately strives for, you know, he's always out there playing, contending. Like the first game back this year, comes back, he's like diving out of bounds. I'm like, dude, we don't have to dive out of bounds. Just save yourself. And he's like, he just doesn't have an off switch. There's a lot of guys that are, you know, maybe healthier that don't play defense. You know, you see a lot of times players get hurt when they're blocking shots, when they're attempting to, you know, go contest and, you know, get down and guard. And, you know, he just doesn't have that off switch. And so, you know, I think all the criticism is fair. I hear it. But I still believe that, you know, the comments of Joel Embiid is washed is just like, dude, when you see him out there, it doesn't matter. You know what I mean? He might not be his usual self yet. You know, as far as like the 35, 12 and, you know, six that he was averaging last year before he went down. But if washed is 29, 10 and five, like, well, then he's one of the best wash players of all time. You know,
I mean, I think there's a chance. There's still a chance that he gets back and he's playing more consistently. And Philly has a great second half of the year. The one thing that's, you know, when I talk to people around the league, they're like, well, maybe like who's the next star available? I don't know if Embiid's going to be that guy who would want to ask out. Like my feeling with him is like he wants to be like Kobe in Philly, where he plays his whole career. He wants to be that type of guy. I think for Philly, Morey in that front office, if this year ends up they're in the lottery and they're hoping to get lucky on lottery night and keep their pick, it's top six protected this year, otherwise it goes to OKC. If it ends up being that, I don't think he's going to jump ship this offseason. I think Philly's going to try to reload and then come back again next year even better. Obviously, challenge is there. Who knows if all the role players will come back, but is that accurate to say that about Embiid?
He's a lifer. Yeah, I mean, it's just like, that's the cool thing about some of these guys. Like, you know, you look at, you know, I'm fortunate to work with some of these guys that, like Jason, who gets drafted into Boston. He's not leaving Boston. You know what I mean? He loves Boston. He has a connection with the fan base. He wants to hang as many banners for the Celtics as he can. Joel, he's been through the ups and downs of, you know, Philly. And you
a
know,
lot like, of ups and downs.
A lot of ups and downs. But
peanut
you know what?
Allergies.
Like, I mean, trust me.
The like, yips.
One day when the actual story is like revealed, it's going to be a documentary.
Burner Twitter accounts.
Everyone is going to have to buckle up. But
what could he? Did he not deal? Like, he checked the boxes for everything. What
yeah,
did he not deal
they've
with?
Reinvented new things that yeah, new you could boxes. Possibly go through, you know? It's like one of those multiple choice questions where you start adding bubbles.
A co-star that shoots with the wrong hand and Ben Simmons.
it's just
you ever
one of those...
talk to Ben Simmons about switching to his right hand?
No, honestly, no? Okay. I mean, I trust me, I only work with guys that come to me. I never really approach other players. And you know, there's obviously things that when I look at, you know, his game or look at a shot, I was like, okay, if I was training him, this is what I would do. And that's, you know, how I started working with Maxi, to be honest with you. You know, when Maxi was, you know, starting out, Joel was like, dude, this guy's going to be good. He's like, I think he has a lot of Brad Beal in him. And that was when he was like, he's like, you should work with him. He's like, if you can develop him into a little bit more of like a killer, a little bit more of a scorer, a little bit more of a playmaker, just like start adding to his game. Did we think 2 years later that he was going to be, you know, guy that was an all-star last year, this year averaging 27 a game? No.
Like,
we
didn't playmaking. Think, he's 6-7 assists per game too.
So, I mean, I think we're going to see him just continue to, you know, get better and better. But, you know, with the Ben thing, you know, obviously watching all of Joel's games, being in Philadelphia, working with Joel all the time, there were a lot of things that I thought like, okay, if I worked with him, this is what it'd be. But to be honest with you, it wasn't necessarily a jump shot would be the first thing. The first thing I thought was always moving him to the four and making him more of a Draymond Green type player.
I thought
he would have been so unbelievable nice. With, you know, with somebody handling the ball, him setting screens, him rolling, him playmaking, because he is an elite passer. You know, he had the ability to get downhill and finish in transition really well in his prime. And so I was like, if you get him in those 3-on-2s, 2-on-1s, that's what made Draymond, you know, so good. So I think that... You know,
I almost wanted the Warriors to trade for him at one point. I'm like, put him behind Draymond and
I agree.
Knows?
But I always thought that was the biggest thing. So I know that like people wanted him to shoot more threes and wanted him to, you know, change his hand in his jump shot or change his mechanics, which I think all made sense. You know what I mean? I definitely wouldn't have had his elbow that far. I would have moved his elbow in. I would have definitely, you know, done some things. But the first thing I would have done is made him a Draymond yes. Green type four player. Because I think that in the transition, I would have loved it. I would have said, if you get a rebound, go. Because he was great in transition. But then in the half court, now you're the four man.
Yes.
And
well,
I think
it looks like with the Clippers, maybe that actually is happening. Now he's paired with Harden there. And we saw in that first game with the Clippers, he's running some elbow action, dribble handoffs. Harden obviously runs the show there. Maybe this is finally the situation where it can happen, playing as a small ball five behind Zubats. Like, this could be it. It's not his prime anymore physically, but maybe now he's in a position where he can actually accept that role. And I mean, the Clippers, similar, they're one of these teams not on the list of the historical contenders. But if Kawhi gets back to being Kawhi and Harden continues playing at this level and Norman Powell continues playing and if Simmons continues fitting and all these other pieces, maybe they play themselves back into it. And then Simmons is in that role with the Clippers right now.
Yeah, no, I think it's, I definitely, when they made the move, I thought it was intriguing just because you do think, you think of if Kawhi's healthy, Kawhi, bigger, longer, taller defender. Ben, bigger, longer, taller defender. They can cause some matchup problems. James, such an elite playmaker. Norman Powell having an unbelievable season. So you're going, man, you know what I mean? They've got some pieces, and there's so much to shake out in the West. You know what I mean? There's so much to shake out in the West. Obviously, OKC looks so dominant right now. So much depth. Shea playing at an MVP level.
He's awesome.
And then getting Chet back, you know what I mean? And throwing him in the lineup. Ihart's been unbelievable pickup for them. So you look at them and you're like, okay, they're probably the team to beat. But then you still got like Jokic out there in Denver, who I'm like, you're not betting against him. Then you've got those other teams.
Nuggets got to be like the best team, the best equipped team to take down OKC.
I agree. We've always like, there's been times where you look and you go, okay, there's a couple cheat codes. You know what I mean? There's a couple cheat codes, and that's just a matchup problem for anybody. You know what I mean? When Jokic is at his best, when Giannis is at his best, when Joel's at his best, when Jason's at his best, like when those top guys are at their best, it doesn't matter who is playing against them, they are a matchup problem. And, you know, you see that, you know, right now the Nuggets are starting to really start win games. Like you look up and you're going, wait, they started the season kind of poor and now they're, you know, one, I don't know what it is, 8 out of last 10 or something like that.
They were 11 and 10 at one point, and ever since then, they have the third best net rating in the NBA. They've been absolutely dominant, obviously with Jokic on the floor, but even without Jokic on the floor, they've been like average. They've been near a zero net rating without him.
And Michael Porter Jr. is putting up a great season. You know what I mean? So I think that when you look at them, they're a well-oiled machine. I always look at how teams close. And they have a really good closing unit. They go to their two play calls. You know what I mean? It's either the right wing, Jokic is backing down, all four guys on the other side. They know exactly where to break. They send one cutter to the rim, one cutter flashing, MPJ on the opposite side, and then Jamal Murray, you know, circling around for a three. Or they go into their dribble handoff set, two-man action on the other side where, you know, Jamal can come off and play make. And if
sometimes
he doesn't have
Russ,
anything,
sometimes it's short Russ roll, in that role down.
Russ, too. You different know what I mean? Look. So. Yeah, I mean, I think that if I was a Nuggets fan, I'd also be excited about my chances of making a run as long as everybody stays healthy.
And of course, like with the Lakers now, they're the only team of all these that have top five to 10 players of Luka and LeBron. I mean, to me, LeBron is still like the fifth or sixth or seventh best player in the NBA. Luka, when healthy, is that as well. It's just they don't have the bigs.
Yeah, the bigs and time. You know what I mean? The time. Because, you know, even in Miami, when they had their big three, it took them, I know they got to the finals, but it took them a year to get over that hump. And, you know, sometimes it does take time. But I think that I was so surprised by how many people on social media were like, well, how is it going to work? They both need the ball in their hands. I'm like, dude, these are two of the smartest basketball players that have ever played the game. Like, that's one of the most underrated parts of the pairing is I think this will extend LeBron's career. Like, I think that the majority of players, and again, I don't work with LeBron, so I'm not in his inner circle, thought like, oh my God, is the end near? Like, we're not going to see LeBron go out there and average 12 points a game and just hang on to his career. Yeah. Like, the kind of the sentiment from everybody is, once he can't average 20 again, he's out. You know what I mean? Like, that's kind of where we wonder if he's going to respect the game in that tone. But like him being able to play with Luka handling a lot of the regular season and him just kind of saving his body for the postseason, I think this could extend his career for another year or two.
Maybe even more than another year or two if he wants it to be. I mean, with him, like he has worked to make himself an elite shooter. He's over 40% from three the last 2 years. He can be an elite spot up guy with Luka running pick and roll over and over. If necessary, he can post up. He's a great cutter. He screens a hell of a lot. I mean, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I'm pretty sure LeBron is near the top of the NBA of like all-star players, non-bigs, in screen set per game. Yeah. And like that's a testament to him having a willingness to do all the other stuff in the NBA. And I think that sets an example for a lot of guys. And so for the Lakers, I don't think they're necessarily going to be a contender this year. But with Luka and LeBron, I have no questions about it working together long term.
I would also say Luka's just a cheat code too, though. Like, he's one of those guys, like when we talked earlier and you said, who are the teams not on that list that could make a run? It's like, we've seen what Luka does in the playoffs.
A team with Luka.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Like, it is a team with Luka, and then you go, oh yeah, and we also have LeBron. Do you know what I mean? So, again.
And Austin Reeves.
Yeah.
Austin Reeves is pretty good.
Yeah, no, they have, I mean, they've got some, and again, I think that it's going to be the most attractive destination this summer for free agents. You know what I mean? There's going to be a lot of, you know, talking about, hey, just come here, get underpaid for a year, and then you'll get overpaid the following year. And so I think we'll see the Lakers get, you know, make a big splash in the offseason and I think have a more of a chance to be a real contender next year.
Now, of some of the other teams on the list, the Knicks you mentioned, we'll see if they get to that 40 before the 20 losses. They've struggled against Boston this year. What have you observed in some of those games between the Knicks and the Celtics? Like, what did the Knicks need to do differently to have more success in a potential playoff series and just the remainder of the season?
Yeah, I think the Knicks, I mean, they have obviously a lot of depth with their starting unit. Like, they have a lot of really good players. Two of the top seven guys right now in MVP, Kat and Brunson, have put together unbelievable seasons. I think their hardest thing is matching up with the Celtics on the defensive end. You know what I mean? I think that's been hard for them because if you switch, now you got a couple guys on the floor that it's hard to stay in front and contain the ball.
Brunson and Kat, you know, those two.
And then even if you drop, now you're still attacking, you know, a guy that Kat has not historically been great in a drop coverage. And so I just think that's their biggest thing is, you know, Tibbs is really, really good coach. And I think that he'll eventually try to figure out something, but they're going to have to scheme up something different. They can't just straight switch. They can't just straight drop. They're going to have to do something else to disrupt the Celtics if they're going to have a chance to beat them in a 7-game series.
I wonder if maybe it could end up being a switch everything with, like, Kat, you got OG Anunoby, you have Mikal Bridges, you still have size and defensive players at the wing with Bridges and OG, and you still have, obviously, Josh Hart as well with his energy and his unique style of play. You have size. It's just Kat on an island or Brunson on an island. Those are points that Boston would pick at in a series, like they have during the regular season. But I just wonder if, by default, that is what they're going to have to go to, especially with the uncertainty about Mitchell Robinson. With him, I mean, we'll see if he returns. We'll see if he can stay healthy. But too big would be the other alternative for them. I just don't know how much you can rely on that.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's one of those things where in the playoffs, it's a different brand of basketball. Like, people don't understand that the regular season and the playoffs, the reason they're so different is just because in the playoffs, that's where you, like, lay out all your good cards. You know what I mean? It's almost like you're holding your trump cards in the regular season and you're like, okay, now we're just going to pound that weak spot in the playoffs. And so I think that is definitely the one question mark. But you see the Knicks, I mean, there's times where they look unbelievable. If they're making their shots and they're defending at a high level, they have a chance to compete with anybody. But I think that's the one thing they're going to have to figure out is how do they contain the ball? How do they contain matchups? And then what do they do when they get those, you know, matchups that aren't favorable in their situations? And, you know, I'm sure that they have a bunch of ideas. I'm sure they spend a lot of time right now trying to prepare for that, but that'll be a big question mark going into the postseason.
Now with Boston, you know, between them and Cleveland, they're the clear favorites in the East. Tatum right now, fourth in MVP voting. Seems pretty locked in there behind Jokic, SGA, and Giannis. I'd imagine for him, like, you wrote a story about him. You've been training him since he was, like, what, junior high or something like that? But you trained him in high school. You had a story in there about how he was arrogant at that time. I would imagine somebody with the edge he plays with, that being fourth in MVP, still has a little chip on his shoulder, like wanting to be even better than that. Is that fair to say with Tatum?
It was pretty cool. So the other night, two nights ago, we had a book signing event in Boston. And at the event, you know, we were going back and forth and, you know, a lot of people can't really crack Jason. You know what I mean? Like, you know, he's very media trained and he's very just nonchalant. And
he's very boring.
People say that, but it's like, he's actually an unbelievable person. Like, anybody that's in his inner circle, if you spend time around him, people are like,
he's
wait.
Great.
Like, he's the coolest dude ever. And I'm like,
but with the media, he's boring.
Of course. Yes. You know what I mean? But it's because you guys all like to hate on him. And you guys don't give him MVPs when he leads a team in points, rebounds, and assists. You know,
not
talking about this year. I'm talking about the finals. But
he should have won finals.
You know what I mean? So it's to me,
just because he didn't score, he got it.
The hate is just, it's something that's funny. But Jason said something. He said, when I won the championship, everyone thought I was just going to put a middle finger up and start basically revealing all of these, like, you know, posts and all these things that, like, I, you know, I've saved over the year. He's like, what I realized is I don't play for the haters. I don't play to prove people wrong. I play to prove all my supporters and all the people that have basically helped me and been there for me all along. I play for them. I prove them right. And I thought that was such a powerful statement that he said in front of the, you know, the crowd there at the book signing, because I was like, that's such a good way to look at it. Everyone wants him just to say F the world. Everyone wants him to go out on this, oh, you guys didn't play me at USA? Okay, chip on my shoulder. And he's like, dude, all I care about is hanging banners. I'm a 26-year-old that has a first ballot Hall of Fame resume on my way to getting another first team All-NBA. Just cause it's going to be stacking up. You know, we have a great chance to win another championship. At the end of my career, you're going to look up and go, oh my God, Jason Tatum was one of the best players that ever played the game. And so I don't think that, you know, obviously he knows where he is. He knows there's only a few players that can look him in his eye when he's out there playing. He also knows what happens when it's crunch time. When you're out there, when it matters in the playoffs, he's proven time and time again what he can do in big moments. You know what I mean? Whether that's going into Milwaukee game 6 and hanging 46 on the Bucks and then beat him in game 7. Whether that's flipping the switch in game 6 against Philly, you know, having that fourth quarter that he had and then going and dropping 51, you know, in the playoffs. Whether that's flashback even farther and there was a play-in game, the first original play-in game against Washington, and he scores 50 in the play-in game. Then he has a 30-point, almost triple-double to close out the finals. Like, he's like, yo, the evidence says I'm a really good basketball player. I don't care what the haters say. I don't care what the media says. I don't care if you guys like my personality. I don't think if you think I'm boring. Like, he's not going to go out there and flip people off. He's not going to go out there and talk shit publicly, you know. But what he's going to do is he's going to back up, you know, everything that he does on the court. And so I think the thing is, if Jason was on a different team, I think he'd be in the MVP conversation every year. I think if Jason was on a bad team, he'd win the scoring title every year. But Jason is all about hanging banners in Boston. And I think that, you know, now that he's got one, it's going to be interesting to see how many more he can win. But that's his only focus. And I know that people are like, there's got to be something inside that says, like, man, F this guy. I'm telling you, it's not. Like, he really does. He's like, listen, Kobe Bryant won one MVP. Shaquille O'Neal won one MVP. You know what I mean? So at the end of the day, if I'm this good and I'm hanging up banners and I'm winning championships and I'm eventually they're going to give me one.
Is this different than he was when he was younger in high school?
In a weird way, you know, in the book, I talk about his junior year in high school. He's in the Final Four and they, you know, they're up by, I don't know, 15 points. And the last 12 minutes of the game, he only attempted one shot. They end up losing the game. The other team came back and won. And I remember after that game, his mom walked over to me and was like, I don't care what you got to do. Like, make him arrogant. Do not ever let him be that passive. And, you know, I remember that senior year, he averaged like 35 points a game in the state playoffs and then outscored the other team in the state championship in the first half. It was 27 Jason, 26 the other team. And I remember that's when he like flipped that switch of like, okay, like as long as I have the ball in my hands, we're good. Doesn't matter what team I'm on. Then in Duke, same thing. You go with Duke. It's
like embracing a healthy arrogance.
A healthy arrogance. Mm. And he knows when he's got to turn it on. And he also knows that sometimes, like, there's a time where you can lose the battle to win the war. And what I mean by that is, like, right now, one of the biggest conversations around Celtic blog world, Celtic X world, is Jason's usage. Because I think they're like 51-3 when his usage is at 33% or above, you know? And so everyone in the Celtics world is going,
more Tatum, more Tatum.
More Tatum equals more wins. There's a direct correlation. Obviously, you know, Joe and, you know, anybody that's around Celtics world is like, you guys understand usage is, you know, there's more than just, you know, having the ball in your hands. That, you know, because it's not like touches changes. It's really like, you know, him shooting more and having more assist and more whatever. But Jason understands. He's like, listen, the reason we're really good is because we have a great team. And so there are nights where I do feel like I deserve the ball more. And I do feel like if I had the ball more, we'd have a better chance at winning. But I can't lose my teammates. I need my teammates to win. And so I think that the thing that people hate about him is we live in a world where, you know, fans are actually more fans of individuals than they are teams a lot of times.
Oh, yeah.
And so they just want Jason to be selfish. And he's like, listen, sometimes the most selfish thing to do is to go put yourself before your team. And, you know, I think that that's what you're seeing now is, trust me, there's some nights where I'll get a FaceTime and like, you know what I mean? Like, if I would have had the Rock more, we would have won. But ultimately, he knows he needs the Rock in the playoffs. He needs his teammates in the playoffs. And I know it sounds corny. I know it sounds boring. But that's all he cares about is winning championships.
In your book, you talk about blueprint bubbles and micro shifts when it came to kind of developing these concepts, which it would be great if you can explain them for the listeners, how much of that is kind of tailored from the experiences of working with these guys like at Tatum, seeing them grow as they develop through those really formative years?
I mean, a ton. So basically, you know, the micro shifts concept came from, it's kind of like Kobe Bryant's detail, but I've always said micro skills. Like, I'm like, you know, the best don't just teach a skill. They teach the nuances, the little details. And so when I started working with Jason, you know, he wrote one of the forwards in the book. He talked about it. The first workout, he's like, I had to leave the gym twice to throw up. He's 13 years old, freshman in high school. Like, you know what I mean? Like, had to leave the gym because I wanted to test him mentally to see if he had it. Once I knew that he had something that, you know, most freshmen don't have, then I was like, all right, now let's get to work. I was like, you want to be an NBA star one day, right? He's like, yes. I was like, all right, this is going to be a boring process. And the first 4 days that we worked out, we did not attempt one jump shot. All we did was work on his jab. Sat there and we would watch film of MJ and Kobe and T-Mac and Melo and, you know, all these guys that were really good in the mid post. And then we'd sit there and we'd work on over top jabs, under jabs, knee jabs. Like, then after day four, I remember being like, all right, you ready to move on? He's like, whew, finally. And he's ready. He's like watching me work out Brad Beal. Yeah. And Brad is in year four with me at that time. So Brad's getting to do all the hezies and this stuff. And we go, all right, now we got the jab, one dribble pull up. And he's like, bro, but that's what it is. It's about most people aren't willing to build that foundation, aren't willing to take small steps that end up being big improvements. And that's how I look at all development. So if you look in like 2022 finals, for instance, the one thing that Jason really struggled with in 2022 finals is when the refs swallowed their whistle, weren't calling fouls on drives, Warriors were beating up his arms on drives. He was not finishing at the rim at a high rate. And so he goes and works hard with Nick Tsang to improve his strength and his muscle and his core strength. He worked hard with me working on his finishing ability, both his ability to drive through contact and finish around the rim. And he's developed into one of the best finishers in the NBA. Like, you go look at his numbers, like, you know, maybe he's not one of those guys that's like, oh, well, we want him to do, you know, all these, you know, spins. But go look at the numbers. The numbers say he's one of the best finishers in the NBA now. And so that's what it is. It's like identifying the one thing that's going to take your game to the next level. And you look at Joel, you know, Joel, when I got him, he was at Kansas averaging 11 points a game. He had made one three-pointer at Kansas, 1 for 5, and shot 66% from the free throw line. Joel was like a defensive player coming into the draft. He's like, we have interviews of him and saying, I'm going to be a defensive player. Joel now, fast forward, has become a guy that's led the NBA in scoring 3 times, won 2 scoring titles the one time he didn't qualify for games played, won an MVP, became one of the most gifted offensive players of all time, most dominant scorers. That's because one thing at a time. It was low post. Then it was mid post. Then we added the hezzy pull-up. Then we added, okay, now we got to move you to the nail like Dirk used to dominate because now it's too easy to double you. And then he expanded to the three-point line. Like, that is a process that takes a long time, but it's one thing at a time. And over, you know, a course of a decade-long career, now you can see the whole game kind of pan out.
What have you noticed, like, with some of these guys who are these success stories, a Tatum, an Embiid, whoever it might be? Bradley Beal has added a lot throughout his career as well. A lot of these guys you work with now, Maxi, Halliburton, still on the rise. What are the differences in their mindsets compared to the guys that don't make those improvements?
I'll give you Maxi because this was a good one. So Maxi came to my gym 2 years ago and he basically was averaging like 20 points a game. And I remember the first time I was like, can you average 26? And he was like, 26? He's like, whew. And I was like, if you don't think you can average 26, you're not going to average 26. And the goal isn't to average 26. The goal is to be a great player that impacts winning and, you know, helps the Sixers ultimately be a better team. I said, but do you think you can average 26? And he was like, And I was like, that's only 2 more 3-pointers a game, or that's only a 3-pointer layup and a free throw a game. And so when he broke it down, he was like, oh, I can do that. And then he went out and was an all-star last year and he averaged exactly 26 points a game. And he's like, bro, how, like, and I was like, that's what the mentality is. You know, same thing with Jason 2 years ago. I was like, can you average 30? No Celtic had averaged 30 and stuff. And he averaged exactly 30. It was like 30.1 points per game. And so I think that a lot of people don't realize that the mindset is so important. You know, the mindset is so important. You look at a lot of players around the league, there's a lot of guys that are 6'6 to 6'8 that are super athletic, but they're not Jason Tatum. You know, they're not that good. And it's like, why? Well, some of it is skill set. Some of it is mindset. But you have to have both of those things. And so I think that, you know, in my day and age, I get so many people that are like, what is this short white guy teaching Jason Tatum, Joel Embiid? Like, all he's doing is rebounding. I'm like, y'all have no idea how much film I'm breaking down, how much, how many analytics that I'm digging through to find, you know, their soft spots, their weak spots. Then putting together a blueprint where we identify exactly what they need to work on, exactly the steps to getting that. And I always look at myself as like a GPS. Like, it's my job to say, okay, here's where you are. Here's where you want to get to. Here's the most efficient and effective way to get there. And if they go off course, it's my job to get them back on course. But ultimately, they're the one driving the car. They're the one that's getting the results. They're the one putting in the work. They deserve all the credit. But it's like, I'm helping guide them there. And so I think that's what it is. It's mentality and skill set and opportunity. Those three things have to be blended for a player to really succeed. But I think that's the thing that average fans don't understand, is that there is a lot of players that are capable of being a lot better. They just don't have the mentality, or they don't have the opportunity. And I think that's when the secret sauce is, when you can blend all those things up and help a player achieve that level that they didn't think they could tap into themselves.
Is there like an inverse story of a situation where you may have had those conversations with a guy and they didn't have that right approach to take that leap in their game?
Well, I would say there's a lot of guys that I wouldn't say that I've kicked out of my gym, like NBA All-Stars, or guys that thought they should be All-Stars. And I was like, I don't believe in you as much as you believe in you, so we're not a good fit. Or I'm like, I don't think so. You know, it's funny because, you know, we just FaceTimed with Trey Murphy before you got here. And, you know, Trey and I started working together this summer. And, you know, Trey's had a huge jump, you know, should be up there at the top of the most improved candidate. And Trey always laughed because he's like, Drew, I never realized how honest you were. You know, early in the season, he'd FaceTime me after a game and, you know, he might have 25 points and he'd be like, I was pretty good tonight, right? And I was like, yeah, I mean, half of my clients would have lowered their average with 25, but yeah, you were pretty good. And he's like, God, he's such an a-hole, you know what I mean? And like, but that's what it is. It's like, there's always another level. And so I'm always honest. You know, we've had conversations with Trey where he said, do you think I can be an All-Star this year? I said, no. I said, I don't think that the Pelicans are going to win enough games, and I don't think that you're going to be good enough to be an All-Star this year yet. Okay, well, do you think I can ever get to Jason Tatum's level? As of right now, I would say no. But do I think that you can be an All-Star? Yes.
Why'd you say no to that, getting to Tatum's
level? Of his mindset. Because of his mindset. I said, Jason, when Jason walks on the court, I said, he looks down on people. He's like, I'm better than Trey. You know what I mean? Like, I said, like, hey, do you want to play one-on-one against Trey in the summer? He'd be like, nah, bro, I'd rather work on my stuff, you know? And then whereas Trey, hey, you want to play one-on-one against Jason? Yeah, I want to see how I can compete against him. It's just a different level. And again, eventually, I hope Trey does crack that code, you know? Like, the thing that I always tell people is, if you spend enough time around me, I'm going to brainwash you into believing that you're better than you are. You know, I really do. But I do think one thing that's important to understand for people is, like, you know, I work with Kelly Oubre. Kelly was somebody I worked with in pre-draft. You know, we started working and he was getting better every year. 3 points and 8 points and 12 points, 16, eventually got to 20 points a game. Then we stopped working together for a couple years, and now that he's back with the Sixers, we resumed working together. And there were times early in the season where he started off and he was super, you know, not efficient. He was just basically head down to the rim, shooting shots that he shouldn't shoot. And I put together a film edit of all the four shots. And I said, hey, this is killing you. Just if we can eliminate these bad shots, your efficiency is going to go up. You're going to be more valuable. I'm going to be able to help you, you know, impact winning more. And you're ultimately going to get better contracts. You're going to be rewarded for that. And since then, Kelly has shooting 51% from the field. And the team loves him. They're like, dude, this is the version we need of you. And so I want people to understand, it's not all about just like score, score, score. Like, you know, be more of a killer means be more, you know, buckets. It's about, how do you impact winning at a higher level? And so, you know, there's times where Tyrese Haliburton, we know when he is aggressive, the Pacers win. Direct correlation. It's a constant battle. You know, me like trying to brainwash him into being more aggressive. And there's times where he defaults back to his nature of just pass, pass, pass. But I'm like, the other team knows you're passing.
Which he's amazing at.
I think he's the best passer in the league. You know, I know there's some other guys you can argue with. You can argue that Trae Young's up there, that Jokic is up there. You can argue there's a couple other guys that are really good passers, but
He's not a better passer than Jokic, but he's a great passer.
I think he is. I mean, he led the NBA in assists last year. I also think that he's able to jump and find passes. I also think that he doesn't get doubled like Jokic does. Jokic gets doubled. Also, if you look, you know, Jokic, 20% of all big guys, basically, dribble handoff. You know, I hate dribble handoff assists more than anybody. The NBA assist, I think, is the worst kept stat.
Oh, it is.
For everybody. Yeah. I'm not singling out Jokic. I'm not singling out Haliburton. But there are some times where I'll look up and Haliburton will have 14 assists. And he'll be like, I had 14 assists tonight. And I'll be like, dude, there were like five of them where you passed. The guy caught it, shot fake, jab, took a dribble, step back. And that was an assist because they caught the ball and directly led to a basket after two dribbles. there's also times where, you know, last year when I'd look and there'd be times where guys would get the ball and the other team would have three, you know, they catch the ball off a dribble handoff, take three dribbles, lay it up. I'm like, that is not
the NBA what I needs grew up to with do the something. Assist. To me, I think the NBA needs to do something about that.
Agree.
Really, because right now it's a stat keeper sitting baseline that makes those choices.
There is a player, I'm not going to say this, but there was a player the other day that I work with that was one away. And I was looking up and they were one assist away. And they did not pass the ball the rest of the game. There was like 45. And then they magically had a triple double. And I was like, and after the game, I was like, yo, they gave you one. And he's like, no. There was a play like at 4 minute mark that they didn't credit. I'm like, there's no way that was an assist. Like, so yeah, the assist is just a bad.
I'm going to do some research to find out who that was.
The rebounds, like a lot of times it depends. Like Kevin Love's a great example. Kevin Love in Minnesota was getting like, I don't know, 14 rebounds a game at one point or something like that. Then he goes and switches teams and now everybody now is trying to go get the rebound and he drops. And people are like, oh, he's not as good of a rebounder. I'm like, most rebounds are uncontested rebounds on the defensive end. Like, I really think that that's the biggest problem with all these stat geeks now is they just look at numbers. They don't watch the games. And so you look and I'm like, assist sometimes is just how many touches you have, you know, like that's it. Like you look at, you know, touches per game. That's a big thing. Then you look at also the system, the offense. That's a big thing. Then you look at rebounds. Sometimes, you know, teams are saying, hey, you guys just hold your guy and he's going to go grab it. Other times they're saying, hey, everybody go after the rebound. That's a big thing. So, you know, shooting numbers. Jason, his rookie season, shot 43.5% from three, but it was mainly spot ups, a lot of corner threes. The next year, he started shooting off the dribble, sidestep threes, and he shot 37 and something. And everyone's like, oh, he regressed. I'm like, no, his shot profile changed. These are difficult shots. Even during the run last year to winning a championship, he shot 38% on all shots, three-pointers, that weren't off the dribble, highly contested threes. But he shot those at 11%. So it was more about shot choice and shot profile and shot selection than it was about a shooting slump, sure. If that makes sense.
Context matters. Like a lot of the time when I'm prepping for a podcast, like listeners hear me say, you know, X percentage on catch and shoot threes, X percentage on dribble jumper threes, because it made major difference. It just is. It's completely different. Even then though, because like there's one dribble, three-pointer to the side. There's also like you dribble the ball four times in an isolation or a pick and roll pull up. The context on all of those dribble jumper threes is dramatically different. Just like on a catch and shoot, it might be above the break, totally uncontested. It might be corner threes, heavily contested. Who really knows? Context matters in these situations. And that's the difference. I remember Bob Myers years ago during one of the Sloan Sports Analytics conferences was talking about there's certain players that we study that are great regular season shooters, but then in the playoffs when that contest is 2 inches closer and the hand in their face is a little bit tighter, their percentages just fall off a cliff because defensive attention and prep is just completely different. Pressure's higher in those situations, and it's true. I mean, it is true. For a lot of different guys, that they fall off a cliff in that playoff atmosphere or against top 10 level defenses. So context matters with all these sets, whether it's DHO assist versus an assist that the player fully did on their own to create for their teammate. It's all of it matters.
Yeah, I think that's the one thing that it's just there's so much access to all these numbers and all these formulas include all these things. So like there's formulas that say like, okay, this is the best player in the NBA based on data. But it's like that data is faulted. That data is overcrediting assists, overcrediting rebounds. It's not including defense. You know what I mean? That's the other thing that I think is crazy is nowadays, you know, there's two sides of the ball, you know, offense and defense. That's why I'm a big believer there should be an offensive player of the year, a defensive player of the year, and then an MVP. Those are separate to me. You know what I mean? Those are all separate to me. And so
kind of like the NFL.
You know, right now it's defensive player of the year. That's like, okay, you're good at defense, just defense. And then it's MVP, which is tending to be very heavily focused on who has the best offensive, you know, statistics.
Sure. I mean, I think something like that would make sense for the NBA as well. And I mean, I think maybe it was even Trey Murphy or one of the guys in that young man in the three crew talked about, you know, there should be an interior defensive player of the year and then a perimeter defensive player of the year.
I mean, and it should be voted on by the players. Like, that's another thing. I understand there have been times where players like make it a joke, a mockery of it, and they start, you know, voting people that have no idea, you know, that they shouldn't be a part of it. But when you talk about perimeter defense and when you talk about post defense, it's like Joel last year. The two guys that finished 1-2 in defensive player of the year were Victor Wembanyama, great defender. I think his floor is probably going to be like the best defender of all time. Yeah. And then Rudy Gobert, who's been, what, four-time defensive player of the year? Joel scored 70 and 50 against him. Then Jokic dominated both of those guys as well. I don't know his exact numbers. And so you're going, they're great defenders, but they're getting dominated by the other top post players.
Which, like, is what happens to perimeter defenders too.
Sometimes.
Offensive players always win those battles too.
Then guys like Joel, who's like, Joel's like, I've never got the defensive credit I deserve. No one, no post player has ever scored 40 against me. No one ever dominates me on the block. No, look up ISOs. You know, when I go head to head against these top guys, I always dominate them. Go look at his head to head versus the other bigs around the NBA. And he's like, then you take me off the floor. Look at how our defense falls off a cliff. He's like, that's what defensive impact is. It's not just blocking shots. It's not just rebounds. It's literally like when you're on the floor, what does the defense look like? When you're off the floor, what does it look like? That is defensive value. And so I think that you hear a lot of players that complain about the voting and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But I think it's just because players know, okay, when you're getting guarded by this guy, it's going to be a hard night. When you're getting guarded by this guy, it's not as hard of a night as everybody else thinks it is.
I mean, I think the challenge with defense also, though, is like, it's so much of it is about five more than just one with defense.
Agree.
Right?
And system. I mean, you think about, you know, system too matters. Sometimes you have
to rotate
that,
help hard over, or is he sagging off? Like, it's so many differences.
Agree 100%. Because you do have some versatile, you know, guy like Bam Adebayo. Unbelievable. He'll switch onto players and plays a lot more on the perimeter and stuff than a lot of typical bigs do. And he does a great job moving his feet, guarding 1 through 5.
Yeah.
Whereas there's other big guys that get to hang back at the rim and their system is built to basically have 4 around 1. So they're obviously going to get more rebounds being at the basket. They're always obviously going to get more block shots because they're around the basket. That's what makes, you know, the conversation around basketball so fun, is there's not one right way to do the voting. There's not one right way to say this person's clear cut better than the other person. But I do think that, you know, a lot of times fans don't understand, you know, the true value of players offensively, defensively, and overall.
I mean, when it comes to the vote specifically, I just wish the vote wasn't tied to contracts. That's my issue.
I think everyone should agree with that.
Regardless of who's casting the votes, I don't care if media gets 100%. I think it would be better if players had some type of say in the end of year awards, just like they do with All-Star, just like fans do with All-Star as well. But like, the fact that the results are tied to the contracts players can receive, to me, is that's absolutely absurd that's even a thing right now.
Yeah, if teams want to pay a guy max money, they should be able to pay him max money. If teams don't, I also
not
think
just because you win, you know, MVP or, you know, agree, get the All NBA for 2 out of 3 years or whatever the rule is. It doesn't make any sense.
Also, the 65 game rule is awful.
You're not a fan of it?
I'm a huge hater of it. Because
doesn't it incentivize guys to play more?
I mean, the real thing is, I think it hurts the NBA more than helps the NBA. For instance, last year, you know, Tyrese Haliburton, he got all NBA and was rewarded with an extra, I think, $41 million bonus. But he came back too early because he had to get that money. So then, you know, now you see him, you know, basically he tweaks it again in the playoffs. So then he misses that, you know, final series against Boston. He's out with an injury. Then he re-injured it over in USA. He starts a season where he has 0 workouts this summer. Zero.
Really?
We didn't get to work out one time this summer. He didn't get to do anything because he was injured. And then he starts the season slow. It's like, we don't get the best version of Tyrese Haliburton, mainly because he had to come back early because of the NBA 65 game.
Like a domino effect going back.
There's also going to be a lot of, you know, you look back at history and stuff like that. Most of the time, voters consider that anyway. But if I get 64 games of healthy Luka, healthy Joel Embiid, healthy, you know, name the other players that are going to be ineligible because of games played, 64 games of those guys at their best is way better than 65 games of somebody else at their best. And so I understand the premise of it was, we don't want players resting. We don't want teams only valuing the postseason. But I really do think that the majority of the ratings issues, or, you know, how everyone wants to talk about what is broken basketball, the game's at its all-time best. Players are the most skilled they've ever been. They make shots more than they've ever been. The game's pace is up and down. The concepts and the details that coaching, you know, does is at an all-time high. It's the fan that is at an all-time low. Fans only care about hitting their parlays. They care about their fantasy teams. Fans don't really care about championships until it comes down to hating on people for championships. They just want
That's
their
individual.
Talking about individuals. Individuals. Meaning, like, so I'll give you an example. What is the biggest criticism of, let's say, Joel Embiid?
He hasn't got won past a championship.
Hasn't got past the second round. Second round means nothing historically.
Efficiency drops in the postseason.
So I would say those are all fair arguments, right? But since when does a second round matter? Because people don't talk about when they argue LeBron, Jordan, they don't say, well, Jordan got knocked out by the Celtics, even though he averaged 40 points and he got swept. But LeBron went to 10 finals. They say LeBron didn't get it done in the championship.
Sure. People do say that, but it's silly to say. It's like knocking Tom Brady from making Super Bowls.
Yes.
Yeah, so he makes the Super Bowl 10 times. Yes.
What I'm saying is the only thing that matters right now to us fans is championships.
Sure.
So the problem is, I think that's an issue because then it downplays the regular season. It downplays individual accolades. It downplays. So like Michael Jordan, when he averaged 37 points a game in a season, he didn't win the championship. Should we just say that's a bad season because he didn't win the championship because he didn't have a surrounding cast?
Of course not.
That's what I'm saying is I think that has been downplayed. There's a lot of really good players that, you know, maybe don't have talent around them. Joel, you talked about his efficiency dropping and stuff like that. Go look at his plus minus in the playoffs. Go compare it to your favorite guy, Jokic. Go look at who you guys love him.
Jokic is better.
Go look at the on-off numbers. It's just, again, Jokic has won a championship. But it's not. If you go look at the data, again, on, off, and again, like even the Raptors series, for instance. Raptors series, they lose in seven. You know, go look at game seven. Go look at that series. It's just crazy. I think that fans just
How mad is it going to make you if the media votes Jokic MVP again?
Not at all. Because the thing that I think that people
not
don't...
Not at all?
No, the thing that people don't realize is I respect the hell out of Jokic. Yeah. We've actually watched Jokic so much. I think that there's... When you look at the teams that we actually watch film of and stuff like that, we think that Denver Nuggets have one of the best systems ever because they get doubled, you know, and when he gets doubled, no one's better than Aaron Gordon at circling and getting ball side of the rim. They used to always send a 45 cutter so that now you had one guy having to take away Aaron Gordon, one guy having to, you know, pull in. They have Michael Porter Jr. lift up so he's available, not stuck in the weak side corner. He's on the weak side. And then you have Jamal Murray pulling over. Like, that's beautiful basketball.
I would love to see Embiid, like, just for a year, plopped into that situation to see how beautiful it would look with him. It would be great.
But no, I think that's the thing that people don't understand is obviously I've always went to war for Joel.
Yeah.
You know, and I've always, you know, looked at...
The leading Embiid propagandist on social
media. Of course,
that's
how I am. But honestly, if you said like, Drew, who are your favorite basketball players to watch outside of your clients? Jokic would be at the top of the list. I think he's one of the best basketball players of all time. And I think that people think just because I've said when Joel plays against Jokic, Joel's better than Jokic. People think that is, and when I say, you know, I might say something offensive defense, I say two-way player versus whatever. People think that I'm just a Jokic hater when the truth is, like, I love Jokic. I think he's one of the best basketball players. I think he's smart. I think he's talented. I think he has unbelievable touch. I think he has great feel. You know what I mean? The only thing I ever knock on him is defensively. Like, that's
He's improved there.
That's a fair knock.
He's improved.
But as far as non-clients, one of my favorite players to watch.
Of non-clients, who's the guy that you haven't worked with that you love to work with the most?
Honestly, there's not many. Victor would be up there because I just think he has so much talent. And I also, it's interesting to me from afar, I've loved watching kind of where they're going to take his development. Because I think there's so many ways you could. You know, you could look at, you know, a guy like him who's shooting a lot of threes and you're going, okay, is he on his way to being like a player like a Porzingis Cat? Now, a better version of those guys, but I'm saying like where he's very perimeter oriented and shooting a lot of threes because he does make him at a high clip. Or could we throw him down in the post? Like imagine him doing what Jokic is doing, passing at his height.
That's what I want.
Oh, that's what I want.
That's
and just,
what I want.
And then you look at like back in the day, like you look at Kevin Garnett when he had a dream shake over both shoulders. And I'm going, how do you block a dream shake over both shoulders?
Impossible.
If you have a hook over both shoulders and he's really good at spinning off guys, even at his height, which is usually hard because usually guys get under you and leverage. And when you spin, they bump you and you get off balance. He actually is really good with that. So that's the thing from afar as a basketball guy. I love watching and saying, where are they going to take his development? Because I think that's where he'll be the most dominant is when they eventually play him out of the mid post and nail. Elbows, basically like around that. And
letting him be a playmaker, right?
Yes.
Yes.
And I would just give him the ball, like especially now where the Spurs are obviously a lot better with that trade. And I think that they're, you know, improving. But I would just give him the ball over and over again and say, make as many mistakes as you can, because we know in a couple of years, if you master this, we are going to be unstoppable.
Well, and that's where with the Fox trade, I do wonder. It's a little different right now with Chris Paul. Chris Paul runs a ton of pick and roll, has the ball in his hands a lot. I argue against that. I'd love to see him come off the bench. But with Fox, we did see it work with Sabonis, with the guy running DHOs, elbows, post-ups, all that. And it worked with Fox, cutting, moving around the ball. And so with Victor, maybe that's the vision for the Spurs, getting Fox. They've seen it work. Whereas they had an opportunity. They could have went and gotten Trae Young if they wanted to. But with Trae Young, we really haven't seen him operate in that type of role. So I'd imagine their vision long term. They know Wemby can play make. I'd imagine they view Fox as a good fit with that. Now, with Fox's downhill speed, I wonder, is that a skill that could help get Victor more lobs than, say, Chris Paul, very slow at this stage of his career? Does downhill speed help Victor roll hard to the rim rather than popping all the time and getting some 85%, you know, shots on lobs at the rim? I mean, that's going to be an elite play for him if they're able to get that more often, too.
Yeah, clear side pick and rolls, uphill DHOs where you throw the ball to Vic. If he doesn't like what he has, just uphill and then he's coming off. It also works well because of the lefty thing, because people don't realize, like, that means Vic gets to be on his left post.
Oh, that's a smart
point. Now he's able to turn right shoulder baseline, and then when he goes uphill dribble handoff, now you got Fox coming off to his left, Vic rolling down the lane where you can just throw it up.
Yeah.
It's a really good fit, you know what I mean, from a basketball side. So, you know, when your X is an O, and there's a lot of opportunity for them to two-man game it. And, you know, they obviously have some other good assets around them. So I think the Spurs are going to be a really fun team to watch moving forward.
I mean, hopefully for them, Vassell can get back to what we've seen in the past. They've had some ups and downs. I still like Sochan. Castle, he wins the Rising Star MVP. He'll be playing on Sunday. We'll see the results there after that game happens. But, you know, last thing with your book here, Drew, it's very cool to see you become an author, man. When did you have the idea for this? When did this kind of pop up for you? Why were you inspired to write it?
Yeah, so I mean, obviously, I've done so much work with my clients on the court, but also off the court. And so being able to help them tap into that next level mentality, but then also break down everything in a systemized way, it was just something that made so much sense. My dad, you know, was a little overweight, and I needed him to lose weight. And so just like I break down the game for the guys and what we're going to work on the offseason, I literally use the blueprint bubbles to break down what we're going to do to attack his weight.
And so that's where I need it. Yeah. I've lost 15 pounds this year. I got to drop more.
He lost 90 in a calendar year.
Wow.
90. And it was simple stuff. But I was like, you have to do it consistently. You have to be able to like break it down. And so that's what we did. And I was like, I think anybody can get any results, whether it's them trying to lose weight, improve their health, whether it's them trying to improve their relationships with their spouse or their kids, whether it's them trying to become more financially free, if they put it in a systemized plan that you are willing to actually take action with. And so that's what inspired the book. Was I had so many people say like, hey, how do you help these NBA guys get results? Hey, how do you help these NBA guys tap into that mentality that they need to get over the plateaus and get over the insecurities and get over the doubts? And
get over the ego too. A lot of these guys are told they're gods since they're, you know, in ninth grade.
But that, again, it's funny because I think that if you polled NBA players and they had to be honest and said, how many of you guys have big egos where you really believe what you portray? Oh, it'd be very low.
It's less than people think.
Lower.
I really do. I think it's less than people think.
Majority of NBA players go through doubts, insecurities. They have stresses. And
hate online as
and,
well.
And it's magnified. Their faults are magnified. So, you know, I am
People like me talking about what they don't do rather than what they do.
Yeah, I'm part-time trainer. I'm part-time therapist. I'm part-time friend. I'm part-time propaganda machine. I'm part-time. I mean, literally, there's so many things that I have to do. But, you know, a lot of our work happens, you know, what I call the deep games, like in the head and your heart, those games that you play, everybody plays those games. Like when you wake up, do you hit the snooze button, you know, like, or do you not BS yourself and get up and do what you're supposed to? Do you snack when you say you're not going to snack? You know, if you're doing, if you're doing dry January, like, and it's it's January 27th and February is right around the corner. Do you say, I almost did it. And now like my friends are having a drink. Do I drink with them? Like there's so many decisions and actions that we end up letting ourselves have a hall pass. And I just believe like 100% is easier than 95. 100%, like all in. That's when you get the results. Not 95% where you give yourself a hall pass, give yourself a little out. And so, you know, trying to bring that from the basketball court to the real world so that everybody can experience the same level of improvement and success that some of the guys that I've worked with have had.
I mean, I do think it's applicable to anybody. If it works with NBA players, if it works with yourself, like you said, your dad losing a ton of weight, whatever the situation is in your life, you can't BS yourself. It's just the truth.
And you know that you're holding yourself back. That's the thing. Yeah. Everybody has these invisible strings, and they know what their invisible strings are.
And you feel like crap after you do it. You're like, oh, what an
idiot
I am.
Every single time.
I'm so stupid.
Once you let yourself down.
Why did I eat that whole box of oyster crackers?
That sounded personal right there.
It is personal.
But no, I think that's the cool thing is like, it's been fun even seeing, like I gave Zach Levine a copy early. I gave a bunch of my clients a copy early. And the majority of my players are like, we don't read. Like we just don't read a book. And then a lot of them pick it up and they'll read maybe like Zach's like, I read the part about my pre-draft. He had a really cool story in the book about his pre-draft and having to tune out a lot of the BS narratives of people telling him he wasn't good enough to play at UCLA. Why should he go in the draft? You know, ESPN reporter saying he's going to look great in a Maine Red Claw jersey next year. Like, all these are true things that were printed about him. Someone said that? Yeah, I have some direct quotes. I left the people out, but there's some direct quotes from the sources.
I wasn't a big Levine guy in the draft. I don't think that was me.
Yeah, no, you weren't in there. Don't worry. But like, he's like, I read that part, and then I wanted to read the foreword by Jason and Joel, and then I started reading. He's like, bro, I'm 3 chapters in. This is good. I'm like, okay, cool. So it's like a book for everybody that doesn't read books is what I keep telling people. Like the longest section is 3 pages. So I'm like, you can pick it up, put it down, pick it up, put it down instead of having those 22 page chapters that you just like feel like, I'm never going to do this.
That is a smart approach. Yeah. It is. Drew, thank you for joining me today, man.
Awesome. I'm glad we finally got to do this.
This is great. Thank you.